Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
To another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's medical podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Todorovic, joined by my co-host, Dr. Matthew Barton. Matt, how art thou?
Very good, thou.
Oh, no, don't think you've read enough Shakespeare.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Do you know any Shakespeare?
Yep.
What?
Fiddler on the Roof.
Don't think that's Shakespeare. Can you quote any Shakespeare?
Something from...
What about anything from Romeo and Juliet? Okay, go.
No.
What about to be or not to be? Do you know to be or not to be?
I was going to say that.
Oh, that's it. To be or not to be?
That's it.
That is the question.
That is the question.
Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of our outrageous
fortunes. Did you study at school?
No, I just read it.
Okay.
I did. I read it. I read it as an adult.
Is it hard going?
Yeah. I understand 20% of it. It's brilliantly written. I mean, if you put it in the context of, what was it, 1600s, 17th century, and he made words up that are currently, like if you look at the amount of words that William Shakespeare made up, It's like, I think it's dozens that we currently use in just everyday language. He was amazing.
Mm.
And the stories that he wrote too have just been continually perpetuated in pretty much every movie trope you can think of.
Mm.
So it's awesome. But the language I find difficult to understand.
Do you think that was the heightened level of English?
No, as in you think it's gone down since then?
No, I just mean like as a language and what he produced as that, you know, the literature. It was English as a language was kind of at its peak grammatically and, you know.
No, I don't think so because they would have had their slang at the time, which just sounds fancy to us now.
Right.
But I think
so you don't think in a language?
No, the purpose of language is economy of words. It's about getting a point across. It's communication. So if you can communicate with somebody using two noises as opposed to 15 noises – then that's economy of words. That's more efficient. That's a better way to communicate.
I guess it depends on how you look at it, right?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of
utility or
mind my language, but there's a lot of wank associated with having to talk with the most eloquent and detailed terminology and the largest word and the most difficult word to comprehend. But if somebody doesn't understand it, then the whole point of the language has disappeared.
That's true.
So that's why I think it's okay to say, hey, Maddie, how you going, bruz? And you say, good chum.
Choice. Sweet as.
All right. How have you been?
Not bad.
We're talking about fasting state today. Did you know that?
Yes. I knew it was coming up because we had done the fed state.
Yes. This episode, like the
fed state. And I prepared for it because I've eaten for 2 weeks.
Wow. So you're in not just a fasting state, you're in a starvation state.
When does it become starvation?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's a delineation.
Is there a biochemical delineation or is it just, no, I think it's just the situational?
I think it's just terminology. I think someone would
like
say...
Like fasting, oh, I'm not going with, I'm going with that food for a period, I'm fasting, or I can't find food.
Well, I would say that fasting is just absence of food, and so you could fast for a year. I'm not saying anyone should, but I'm just saying like you could say 12 months of fasting. Starvation is probably a mode, a physiological state in which probably could be classified by certain...
Or is it just access to resources?
Yeah, could be that too. I don't know. Maybe we should have figured the answer out before we discussed it. But no, this week, just like the other episode on Fed State, this week on fasting is brought to the dear listener by the Biochemical Society, okay. I should say, who have provided us with
the United Kingdom
some funding in order to produce a couple of these biochemistry-based episodes.
And you also presented to a biochemical...
Biochemistry organisation. I presented on Friday last week. So this time last week, not this time, but last week.
Yeah, what time was it?
Well, when they asked me, so I got an email from the president, I believe, of the biochemistry. So I think it's called the Association of Biochemistry Educators in the United States. And I got asked by email, would love for you to be our plenary for the conference. So that's the main speaker, which is brilliant. It's an honor. It's really nice. And, you know, you say yes to these things and it's virtual, so it's online. And I didn't even think about the time difference from Australia to the US, which is pretty much just the opposing time of the day.
Like 12 hour difference.
Yeah. So what it ended up being was she said, well, the conference begins at 1 p.m. That's when you present. And I go, yeah, 1 p.m., no trouble. Didn't even think about Australia. And then as it got closer, I found out that this was 2:30 a.m. on Friday, which is a tricky time to do a presentation because it's the middle of the night.
Yeah. This is like when you get up in the middle of the night and put the television on and there's just these weird random television shows. You were like that, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. I was that person that they were watching. But it wasn't middle of the night for them. So anyway, I had to...
Did you sell anything?
No, I wasn't. It wasn't like, was it Danos Direct? It's just like, look at this. This necklace usually sells for $2,500, but today you can get it for $9.99 if you send us the details now. So it was 2:30 in the morning. I woke up, put my alarm for 2 a.m. because I was just going to wake up and just roll out of bed and present. But I woke up at 1 and... couldn't go back to sleep.
Oh, so you didn't actually...
I didn't even need
the alarm.
No, didn't need the alarm.
You're like Kramer.
So I had to get everything sorted and the presentation went very well. I did a friend of mine in the US who's a comedian and a magician in Vegas, Matt Donnelly.
He was there. He's actually been on the podcast before, by the way.
He has actually. We did an alcohol episode with him. Because he's a performer, so he knows how to sort of break the ice with an audience. And I said to him, you know, what's the best way to start a presentation? And he said, the best way to start a presentation is by picking something that's relevant about the room or the place or the time and making an seemingly off-the-cuff joke about it, and then everyone gets comfortable and then you can talk about whatever you talk about. So when I entered, I said that I said, look, thank you, everybody, for having me. Kim, the organizer, said to me, asked me, would you like to present and be our plenary? It would be an honour. And I said, that would be great, but I've got one condition. That condition is it needs to be early in the morning because I'm a morning person. And she said, yeah, not a problem. And she stuck to her guns and made it 2:30 in the morning. So, and that was good. Everyone laughed. Everyone said, this is great. And then half the people logged off. But anyway, it went well. How have you been?
You asked that.
Okay, good. Should we get started?
Let's get started.
All right. I think we should get started. Fasting, state metabolism. Give us, before we go into the weeds and the nitty-gritty, give us an overview.
Do weeds provide nutrients to break you out of a fast?
Weeds or weed?
They'll make you more hungry.
Very true. So you then soon be back into a fed state. But we're talking about fasting. So generally speaking, in the fed state, you've just eaten, right?
Very good.
Right? And we said that in the fed state, because you've saturated the bloodstream with glucose, and let's just focus on glucose as the main nutrient in this case, but we'll talk about others. Because you've the system's flooded with glucose and your blood glucose is high, it goes above the normal euglycemic level. So the homeostatic range, which is between 4 to 6 millimoles per liter.
How much is that in teaspoons?
Oh, okay. Wow, really jumped the gun there. I thought that it would be good to put this into context because 4 to 5 millimoles per liter makes no sense unless you're within medicine.
Or
a chemist, true, probably predominantly chemistry. I don't think a lot of medicos understand what it means either. So let's take the middle of that 5 millimoles per liter of glucose, so of per liter of blood. That's equivalent to about 0.22 teaspoons of glucose, not tablespoon, teaspoon, 0.22. And because you've got about 5 liters of blood in your body, you could say that 5 millimoles per liter is equivalent to a heaped teaspoon of glucose within all the blood of your body. So if you take all the glucose floating through the blood in your body
right now
at a normal level, at the euglycemic level.
Let's say 5 millimoles.
It's a heaped teaspoon.
Not much.
About. Not much. So when you eat the meal in the fed state, like we spoke about the other week, your blood glucose level can double that. You can have 2 heaped teaspoons, right? You can go to up to 10 millimole per liter. And that increase will stimulate responses that try to drop it back down. So insulin release, specifically insulin.
Yeah.
Glucose jumps into tissues and that glucose will be utilized to make energy. And then once we've got enough energy, the rest will be
stored
as glycogen or fatty acids.
For another day.
But in this case.
And this is the other day.
And exactly. But now we are 3 to 4 hours post-eating, post-prandial.
That's fair,
And any time after that. And our blood glucose levels have now started to fall. So what would you say broadly, like I just covered with the fed state, how would you sort of define the fasting state broadly before we go into the details?
Yeah, that's fine. I think you've done it.
Well, just low blood glucose?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nothing else.
Well, fasting, just
But the point of it is meals. What happens in the fasting state is to boost blood glucose levels.
Correct.
And this is going to be mediated by glucagon and other hormones.
Yep.
But also the main job of this whole thing is just to boost that blood glucose back up. So what we...
Well, yes. So I think the main player in doing this is the liver.
Yeah.
And the liver's just doing that for predominantly two other organs, just to keep the glucose in the blood because two other organs really want to keep using glucose for their energy metabolism.
Right.
And that's the brain and the red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
So those two organs in a fasting state still would prefer to have glucose as its primary energy source, meaning to make its ATP.
Yeah. Well, neurons, like you said, brain, the lens of the eye and retina love glucose as a primary energy source. The lens.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought the lens really has any
That's what cells. I thought, but that's what I read in a...
Maybe the cornea.
...article. It said lens.
Wow, I thought that was just a...
Yeah, I thought it was just epithelium. Right? But it's... Anyway, and red blood cells.
Or retina. I thought it was retina.
Well, it's retina as well.
Yeah.
Lens and retina.
Retina makes sense because it's very energy dependent, right?
Yeah. Neurons, let's just say eye, red blood cells, and renal medulla. Are the major muscle requires glucose significantly, but they're the major ones.
So when you say renal medulla, you just mean the nephron cells?
It's probably what it's referring to.
Which is interesting.
But it says renal medulla cells. That's what the literature
just
says.
Just the medulla of the kidneys, which is mostly the nephrons.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be other interstitial tissue.
Yeah.
But the point is there's a couple of tissues that just want glucose.
Yep.
The brain being one of them and red blood cells being another. That's a big take-home point.
Well, because red blood cells don't have any other organelles.
Yeah.
So they really can't really use many other intermediates besides glucose.
Yeah.
Just to do glycolysis.
Mm.
And we spoke about this before, but... You know, why does the brain want glucose when it could be used in fatty acids? I mean, I know that it can't get fatty acids because it's kind of locked out of it.
What do you mean?
Well, fatty acids, do we want to mention this now or when we get to fatty acids? Oh, I think look, I'm just, okay.
I think when I think it's okay to say that, you know, if the brain is using glucose, why doesn't it use other energy sources?
So when fatty acids are liberated from fat cells, they aren't just released raw into the blood. So they're just not like fats.
They're not just raw in the blood. You're right. That's the way of describing it.
It's not like this fat is spilling over into the blood and making your blood just like olive oil. Right. It has to get carried on a protein.
Yeah.
And this protein, albumin, predominantly. I'm sure there's others. But albumin's carrying it around the body for other tissue to use in a fasting state like the liver and muscles, let's say. But that protein can't offload it through the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah.
So that means the fatty acids aren't being able to be utilised in the brain.
They can't cross the blood-brain barrier very well. So that's one reason why the brain doesn't use fatty acids. The other is it can produce relatively large amounts of oxidative stresses, which is not good for the brain. It's very sensitive to oxidative stress, hence why neurodegenerative diseases like dementia and Parkinson's disease are strongly associated with oxidative stress. And the other one is that glucose is just a really fast way to get energy. And the brain is fast. Mine is. Yours is a bit slower, a bit sluggish. You know, you're not as smart.
I get it. But you didn't have to spell it out.
Well, I did because your brain's not that good.
Right.
So we got that?
Yep.
Now what?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story.
Oh, cool.
Can I tell you a story?
Yeah. Is it relevant to
It's relevant. It's about fasting.
Okay.
It's about a fast that probably wasn't intended.
Right.
Okay. So when I was when I was working in America, occasionally at night I would work.
Here we go.
No, I would sometimes work on because I worked in America at a ski resort.
Spit it out. I don't know what ski resort,
but sometimes at night.
But at night, you were?
Night skiing, I'd work on the chairlift. Have you been on a chairlift before skiing?
I've never been skiing.
Oh, never. Okay. So I'm not going to explain what a chairlift is, right? You know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think every human being knows. And if they didn't, I think the two words put together make sense.
Okay. So anyway, usually what it involves is a person at the bottom of the lift and the person at the top of the lift.
As in working it?
Working it.
Yeah.
So it's obviously cold. So the person at the top stays in a little hut.
Okay.
And because it's night and it's cold, usually you feel tired. Yeah. So you have to keep yourself awake. Now,
is there a heater in there?
It's a heater, but that sometimes makes it worse because you get more tired.
Yeah.
So anyway, this guy gave me a book to read.
Okay.
And it was a biography of this guy called Aaron Ralston.
Oh, yes, okay, I've heard of him.
No, you probably haven't heard of him because it's a very rare book.
Oh, okay. No.
Biography. Let me get into it.
Okay.
So this particular guy called Aaron Ralston.
Yep, heard of him. Very famous.
He was a famous mountaineer.
Yes. Oh, so he's famous now.
Yeah, but you don't know any mountaineers.
I don't think he was a famous mountaineer at the time. I think he was just a self-proclaimed mountaineer. I think he was famous because of what happened subsequently.
In the small community of mountaineers.
Oh, okay then.
So he, anyway, let me cut to the chase.
Please don't.
In 2000, well, first of all, I have to be accurate with my geography here because we've been reprimanded by...
Yeah, we're not good at knowing our United States.
By a professor in Ottawa, which is in Canada, Michael.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. So anyway, I'm going to be accurate with the...
What did they say?
They said our geography's poor, particularly of North America.
Yeah.
They said basically we think everything's above the Arctic Circle.
Is it?
No. All right. So anyway, this particular guy, Aaron, in 2003, he went canyoning. Now,
cool.
I think he resided in Colorado.
Yeah.
So the next state across, if you go west,
next state to what?
Utah to Colorado.
Utah. Yeah.
So he's in the Blue John Canyon, which is east of the Wayne County area of Utah, and that's near
Blue John, and it's in Wayne County. So it's like
Blue John Canyon was in the Wayne County.
Yeah, not confusing at all.
But now this is in a unit of canyons called the Horseshoe Canyon of Canyonland National Park in Utah.
Does any of this matter to the story?
I'm just being geographically accurate.
All right.
So he was canyoning. Not exactly sure what that entails.
It means you just hang by a rope and swing from one side to the other.
And
I don't think it means that.
He was moving down a canyon, yeah. and he dislodged a big boulder, which was like 300 kilos, mm. and it fell with him. Mm-hmm. And as he was falling down the canyon, obviously the canyon gets
narrower.
Yep. And his right arm got stuck between the boulder and the wall.
Yes, and crushed has heard of this.
He crushed his hand.
Yes, it's a famous story.
And
it's a movie called 128 Hours.
Seven.
127 hours. Yeah, yeah. It's not that famous. I can't remember it, but it's too many hours. But yes, 127 hours. James Franco played the character.
Is he the guy off Spider-Man?
He was the guy off the first Spider-Man. He played Green Goblin's son.
Son, that's right.
Yeah, Spider-Man's best friend.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. So I did. Yeah, I think I've watched that movie. Yeah. So anyway, he got stuck there.
Yep.
For that many hours, which
127.
Is which is like 5 days.
Yeah.
Initially, he had a bottle of water. I think some burritos, maybe an energy bar.
Okay.
But then he ran out of that. And he went through periods of saying, oh, there's no way I'm getting out of this, mm-hmm. to I think then he hallucinated. And he was, I think he'd done his final goodbye video.
Okay. Did he make a video?
Yeah, he made a video.
Oh, yeah, it's in the movie.
And he thought, this is it. I'll write on the rock wall. My name, date of birth, when I'm about to die.
Yeah.
But then that night he hallucinated, and the dream that he had was him with his child and himself missing an arm.
Wow.
And I'm not sure if he had some kind of prosthetic.
Okay.
But he thought that was something to kind of go, well, maybe I should take my arm off. And so the next morning because he'd already attempted to try to take it off, but he only had like a small kind of pocket knife.
Yep.
And he thought, I'm never going to get through the bone with this.
Yeah.
So the next morning he thought, oh, what I can do is use the wall and the boulder as a vise and just swing out and break.
Snap it,
and then cut through the skin, the muscle with a knife. But I think when he got to the tendons and the...
Get a bit tricky. It's hard to cut.
Yeah.
It's sometimes hard to cut a steak with a steak knife, let alone your arm with a little pocket knife. It would have been rough.
So tourniquet with the camel pack.
Yeah. So what's this got to do with
So anyway, this is just an example of, in this situation, he was obviously fasting because he was running out of...
Oh, so it helped.
Yeah.
This is one of the benefits of fasting. To cut your arm off. I get it now.
This is the benefit of why we have this biochemical backup system.
Did it help him in this process?
Yes, he survived.
Oh, so it helped him.
Yeah.
How do you know that? How do you know it was fasting that helped him?
Not fasting, but the biochemical fasting state of what you can do without the abundance of glucose anymore to keep yourself going over hours, days, weeks, potentially months.
Okay. Well, that was interesting, I suppose, in part. It was there was something to it, I suppose.
So with this particular gentleman, Aaron.
Yeah. More about him, okay.
5 days, let's just say.
All right,
he was without food.
Yep.
I know he had a bit of food, but let's just assume that he had no food from the get-go.
So we change the story.
What is his body doing to maintain homeostasis?
I see. Now I see what we're doing. Okay, great question. Great question. So like we said, after 3 to 4 hours, his body is in a fasting state. And like you said, he's there for 127 hours. Give or take. So
he's got a little way to go.
Yeah, so what is happening? So the first thing we need to think about is that once we hit 3 to 4 hours, blood glucose levels drop. That's the first thing. And we know homeostasis is about maintaining happy, healthy balance. We spoke about fed state, where it goes too high. We try and bring it back down using insulin. But now it's going too low. And so this drop in blood glucose will stimulate another hormone to be released from the pancreas. It's not insulin in this case, but glucagon.
Okay, so glucagon, where is that from?
That's from
you just said the pancreas.
The pancreas, yes. But it's from the alpha cells, not the beta cells.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all sitting there within the pancreatic islet cells. And so once this glucagon is released, this is really important. The glucagon is a really important regulator within the fasting state because... Generally speaking, when you've got glucose abundantly available and insulin's available because it stimulates the release of insulin when you've got enough glucose, the insulin not only triggers glucose to enter tissues like muscle and fat, but it also stimulates the enzymes of glycolysis and the Krebs cycle to undergo those processes. Because when you've got glucose and you undergo glycolysis, you make energy, either directly or indirectly, directly by making ATP or indirectly by making NADH.
Okay.
And then when you go to the Krebs cycle, it does the same. It will make some ATP directly or some indirectly through NADH or FADH2. Those NADH, FADH2 molecules, they're carriers for electrons and protons. So if you take a hydrogen atom, so the first atom on the periodic table, it is made up of one positive charge called a proton and one negative charge called an electron flying around the outside. Because they balance each other out, a hydrogen atom is neutral. It's just H. But what we do with the glycolysis and the Krebs cycle is we're trying to rearrange a six-carbon molecule called glucose in a way that we can pull off protons and electrons. And that's what NAD plus does and FAD does. They pull off hydrogens.
And what are those reactions called?
They're oxidization reactions. Okay. They oxidize these molecules by allowing those molecules to lose their electrons. So NAD plus will pull hydrogen and electrons off, or at least hydrogen off, which contains electrons, and so does FADH or FAD. They carry the hydrogen to the electron transport chain.
Which is in the mitochondria.
That's right, the inner membrane, and feed the electrons to the proteins. And that excites the proteins. It excites them so much that they can then take the protons, the hydrogen ions, the H plus, because obviously we've now pulled the negative electrons off them. So it's just an H with a plus left. And it excites those proteins so much that they pump the hydrogen up into the what we call the intermembrane space of the mitochondria, the space between the two membranes. Now we have a really high concentration of hydrogen ions in the intermembrane space. High concentration, it wants to go down its concentration gradient, so it moves through another protein called an ATP synthase. And as the protein moves down, that energy spins a turbine that produces all this ATP.
Mm-hmm.
So the point I'm trying to get across here is that in the fed state, glycolysis and Krebs cycle is noted by its energy-producing ability, right? But when we are in a...
And then so insulin is...
And insulin's mediating that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the thing is, when glucagon is high, because blood glucose levels are low in this fasting state, it switches off those enzymes.
Yeah.
So we don't make ATP. And you might think, wait a minute, but we're fasting. Don't we want to make ATP? But the point is that at the moment, all it cares about is remedying the blood glucose levels.
Mm-hmm. Or the liver is.
The liver. Yeah. Yes, exactly right. Sorry. We're focusing here on the liver. It's the liver that's trying to fix the low blood glucose levels.
Yeah.
And so it does this by having the pancreas release glucagon. And when we look at this whole process, it wants to make glucose. So if you look at how can we make glucose, we go, okay, there's one easy way we can do it. We stored excess glucose as glycogen.
Yep.
And that process goes glucose to glucose-6-phosphate. Glucose-6-phosphate shoots off the side to glucose-1-phosphate, and glucose-1-phosphate is stored as glycogen. Now, when glucagon is present, it says, hey, glycogen, break up again, go back into glucose-1-phosphate, go back into glucose-6-phosphate, and try and turn into glucose. The problem is all of that's reversible except the very last step.
In
the liver, going from, well, in any tissue, basically, you can't go from glucose-6-phosphate to glucose. Because, and if it's phosphorylated like that, it can't leave the tissue. Glucose-6-phosphate has a phosphate. It can't leave the tissue. That's one of the reasons why it becomes phosphorylated, right? Or has a phosphate group, I should say, attached to it.
Yeah.
So we need a way to reverse glucose-6-phosphate to glucose so it can jump out of the liver and go back into the bloodstream to fix blood glucose. That's what glycogen does. Glycogen switches on an enzyme that allows for that to be reversed. Not glycogen,
glucagon.
What did I say?
Glycogen.
Sorry. Glycogen. glucagon switches on an enzyme that allows for it to be reversible. And that enzyme is glucose-6-phosphatase. So now with the presence of, so when blood glucose levels are low and glucagon levels are high, this combination of things tells glycogen to start breaking up and switches on glucose 6-phosphatase
yep.
and allows for glycogen to go glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate, glucose 6-phosphate, and then to glucose, and then it can jump out of the liver and go into the bloodstream
yep.
to try and remedy it. And this is going to be the predominant way we fix our blood glucose levels in the short fasting term. State. So after an 8-hour fast, so a nighttime fast, you know, you've gone to bed, wake up in the morning. If you haven't had a midnight snack, it's been 8-odd hours. At this time point, glycogen is being used between 40 to 70% of the glycogen. 40 to 70% of the glucose being made to fix the blood glucose levels is coming from glycogen.
So when people are to compete in events where they're going to expel a lot of energy, and we hear these terms of carbo loading.
Yep.
Where they have a big bowl of complex carbohydrates the night before, let's mm-hmm. say like pasta.
Sure.
What potentially that is doing is just filling your liver up and muscle
yep.
as much as it can with glycogen
yep.
because that's the preferred energy source that you're going to be relying on the next day when you're competing, at least to a point that you've burnt them all off.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first energy source you're going to go to will be the glycogen stores. But don't get me wrong. It's not like it only uses glycogen the glycogen's gone.
But it's just the predominant. This is just the predominant.
Yeah. So when it uses glycogen predominantly, but simultaneously it will use other sources okay. and we'll get to that point. So your body can store around about 190 grams of glycogen and you need about 160 grams for a day. So you've probably got about 30-odd hours of glycogen.
Depending on what you're doing.
Exactly. So if you're doing... So for exercise or hard manual labor, that's going to go well within 30 hours.
So for Aaron, he has...
Who's that?
Aaron.
Oh, that James Franco, yep.
So he's been trapped. So yep. for approximately 8 hours, half a day, mm-hmm. he's going to predominantly be using glycogen
yep.
as his preferred energy source
yes.
to keep his blood glucose at a steady state.
Now, to complicate it in his case, he's going to be a bit stressed.
Yep.
And when you're stressed, you release adrenaline and cortisol.
Yep.
And these two chemicals potentiate glucagon. So they can support the role of glucagon, which means they probably mobilize more glycogen into glucose
yep.
than would happen in a normal fasting state at the same time.
Yes.
So he's probably going through his glycogen faster.
Yep. And then also, like, because he was in the middle of a desert,
mm-hmm.
Definitely something he reported upon in the book is during the day, it's obviously nice and hot.
Yeah.
But at night,
freezing.
It gets really cold. And yeah. so during the night, he would speak about how completely uncomfortable it became because I think he even used really? Ropes to
but
wrap around
the day,
himself.
It was fine to have your arm under a rock. That was absolutely comfortable.
Anyway, so as you would probably imagine, if you're super cold, you're going to be shivering.
Yep.
And so that's going to be generating a lot of energy
yep.
to keep you warm. Mm. And so his energy expenditure would be up.
Yeah, that's right.
For that particular.
So in the early stages of fasting, the glucose that's been made to try and fix blood glucose levels, 40 to 70% are coming from the stored glycogen, which are predominantly in the liver. It's going to be coming from the liver mostly because even though the muscle stores glycogen, it's selfish and keeps it to itself. So if the muscle needs stored glycogen, it uses its own and keeps it to itself.
Yeah, and the reason
liver
for that
will mobilize its glycogen for the whole body.
The reason for why that is because the muscle lacks that last enzyme.
Yes, that's right. It does. Glucagon will not turn it on for it. It's just the liver and kidneys basically. And I think you sent me a paper that said the intestines to a degree that will switch this enzyme on.
So this is what is this actually called? This is called glycogenolysis?
This is called glycogenolysis, okay. That's right.
And so just to reiterate, the liver is doing this.
Yep.
It's pumping glycogen, it's breaking down glycogen and pumping glucose out to the body.
Yep.
So is the kidney?
Yep.
Have you got numbers
sort
on?
The kidney's like the last one to do it. The kidney's sort of like the last organ to mobilize glycogen to glucose.
Okay. And then the muscle is also breaking down glycogen, but it just can't release it into the body.
It's selfish.
Because it hasn't got that last enzyme step.
Yeah, so it keeps it to itself.
So that just becomes oxidized into ATP through glycolysis.
That's right.
Okay.
All right, now.
Do you want me to Are you done with glycogen?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want me to quickly just mention a couple of disorders, or you prefer not?
No, let's do all the disorders at the end.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Sure.
So as the time goes on, right, you go from 8 hours to, let's say, 14 hours, the role of glycogen breaking down to release glucose becomes less and less and less, and it starts to become more reliant upon other sources. Now, these other sources are non-carbohydrate-based, which means they aren't any products that you'll see within glycolysis or the Krebs cycle. They come from outside of these processes. And generally, they're non-hexose-based, or they're non-6-carbon molecules, right? They're non-carbohydrates. And there's a couple of different types of what we call gluconeogenic substrates.
Okay, what's that word mean?
So if you break it up, gluco means glucose, neo means new, genesis means the beginning of. And if you read it backwards, it's the beginning of new glucose.
Okay.
And so that's what it's trying to produce, new glucose. So what we've done so far...
And again, this is just the liver.
Yes. And what we've done so far is we've produced old glucose, because glycogen was glucose to begin with.
Yep.
But these substrates, they weren't glucose.
Okay.
And just to mention it at the front end, these are lactate, glycerol, and amino acids.
Okay, so lactate, these are the substrates. Lactate comes from anaerobic respiration.
Yes.
And that's predominantly from muscle and red blood cell sources.
Yeah.
What was the second one?
Glycerol.
Glycerol, so that's a backbone for storing fat.
Yeah, so triglycerides.
Yep. And the third one?
Amino acids.
And that's building blocks of a protein.
Yes. Can we start with lactate?
Yep, sure.
All right. So if we start with muscle, we know that when muscle contracts, it requires ATP for the cross bridge linking and so forth. So it needs ATP. The glucose it currently has, it will turn into ATP and NADH through glycolysis, but then it can feed to the Krebs cycle and produce more ATP and NADH and FADH2, and then feeds the NADH and FADH2 to the electron transport chain to produce that ATP. One thing we didn't mention about the electron transport chain is that once we've produced all that ATP, we've just got all of these electrons and protons left over. Now, the thing is, electrons, they're damaging to tissue. Hmm. We don't want them hanging around. And protons, which are hydrogen ions, that's acidic. Hmm. So they're damaging. We need a way to mop them up, to buffer them up. And this is where oxygen comes into play. Oxygen is what we call the final electron acceptor. So oxygen will take those electrons and take those protons and wrap it up to produce water, H2O. And water's innocuous. Water is, you know, makes up 60 to 70% of our body weight. We have it, we love it, we need it. And we've just taken two things that can damage us and turn it into something that we require, but we need oxygen to do it.
Okay.
Now, if you are a muscle tissue and you're in the gym and you're doing crazy fast bicep curls, or you're doing sprint training where your muscles need a lot of ATP to contract very quickly,
mm-hmm.
you might not have enough oxygen in the system to be able to let the electron transport chain do its thing.
Right.
So it backs up into the Krebs cycle, and backs ultimately up into pyruvate, which is the final product of glycolysis.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, if it backs up to pyruvate, pyruvate's got nowhere to go, because pyruvate cannot go backwards. It's irreversible.
Yes, so which we'll speak to a bit later.
Exactly. Yeah. So pyruvate needs to turn into something, and what it turns into is lactate. So in muscle, when there's not enough oxygen to meet the energy demands, called anaerobic respiration, pyruvate turns to lactate.
Okay, so instead of the...
Not lactic acid.
Okay, so instead of the pyruvate normally going into the mitochondria through a couple of steps to make acetyl-CoA, instead, because you're without oxygen, it's making ATP into lactate.
Yeah.
Okay, and so lactate will start to build up in the muscle if you're exercising vigorously. Is that correct?
Yes, it doesn't make ATP into lactate, it turns pyruvate into lactate.
Oh, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
And so this lactate, is it similar to what was happening in the electron transport chain, that it is an acid? It's
no.
So in that case, because we do hear that when your muscles are exercising vigorously, you are releasing this byproduct, whether it's lactate or lactic acid.
Mm-hmm.
and that is causing that burning sensation. Is that true?
No. So what used to be said and what still is stated in textbooks is that exactly that. You make lactic acid through anaerobic respiration, and lactic acid tells you that there's going to be hydrogen ions being released. And then once the hydrogen ions are released, you get a conjugate base, which is the lactate. So it goes lactic acid, splits apart to release hydrogen ions and lactate. And then it's those hydrogen ions that make the muscle tissue damaged and burning and less able to contract and so forth. We don't necessarily, there's some people who think it's still the case. We don't necessarily think that this is actually what's happening. What we think happens is that pyruvate turns directly into lactate.
Okay.
And in doing so, it actually produces NADH, mm-hmm. which is a reducible agent, which means it can be used to make ATP, yeah, which is yeah. a great thing.
Yeah.
But then the question is, well, where's the acid coming from?
Yeah.
And the answer is ATP production. When you make ATP, you make acid. So the thought is that because of the NADH that comes off, which can be utilized elsewhere, such as the electron transport chain, for example, it can make hydrogen ions. So creating ATP creates hydrogen ions.
Okay, so what it's basically, it's still doing the driving of the electron transport chain, but you haven't got oxygen to mop it up.
Potentially. The other thing is that the ATP doesn't necessarily come from electron transport chain because the NADH can be fed and used elsewhere as an energy source, such as it can be utilized as a substrate to reverse glycolysis, right? Because we need that substrate to reverse glycolysis. So that's the thought.
But is it fair to assume still, regardless of what's happening, that if you were to put a monitor into your muscle and you are in an anaerobic situation,
it becomes acidic.
It's acidic.
Becomes acidic. But it's not,
just
because
not exactly
of
sure how.
Lactate is a buffer. Lactate can actually bind to hydrogen ions.
Yeah, okay.
So it can mop them up. So in actual fact, we think now that lactate isn't there as the bad guy, but lactate is being produced because it's one way of being able to mop up the hydrogen ions that are being produced elsewhere.
Okay.
Or by another thing.
But it could be representative that the state there is it's an acidic state, but it's not causing the acidic state.
Yes, that's right. Now, if the muscles are producing that lactate.
Because what, just one thing there, I came across this recently and it just said maybe, and please shoot this down, maybe an evolutionary role here is, well, if you are in an anaerobic state, so you're exercising to an extent where you are producing lactate as the end point, or it's soaking up the acid,
mm-hmm.
your muscles, because it's becoming more acidic for whatever reason, it's becoming painful or it's discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to dial back your exercise intensity, which is then going to allow oxygen to come back in.
Yes.
And then that can
But we also need to
state.
Remember that there's other things that cause discomfort within the muscle tissue, such as high ATP levels can actually stimulate nociceptors. Protons, so hydrogen ions, stimulate nociceptors. Potassium stimulates nociceptors. All a range of other chemicals being released. The ionic imbalances, so electrolyte imbalances, can do this as well. So there's
a lot of things.
A range of factors going into this.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
All right, now, so we said that the muscle will take pyruvate and turn it into lactate, but it can't do much with it in the muscle. So it must leave the muscle, jump into the bloodstream, and then go to the liver.
Yep.
And the liver will take that lactate and turn it back into pyruvate. Now, the question is, wait a minute, if the muscle can take lactate and turn it to pyruvate, but the problem is, remember originally, we're in a fasting state. We've got low blood glucose levels, right? When the low blood glucose levels are there, I said glucagon's high. And if glucagon's high, we inhibit glycolysis and Krebs cycle.
Yep.
So we don't want pyruvate to jump into the Krebs cycle and turn into acetyl-CoA, right? Right, so if in the muscle, lactate can turn into pyruvate but can't go back that way, can't go forward to create acetyl-CoA in the Krebs cycle because that's switched off from the glucagon, but it can't go backwards because it's irreversible, what can it do? And like I said, it jumps out, goes to the bloodstream, goes to the liver, and liver takes lactate and turns it to pyruvate, but you're going to go, the same problem.
Hmm.
But the thing is, no, not in the liver, because glucagon in the liver will stimulate the production of an enzyme that allows for pyruvate to turn into something called oxaloacetate.
Even though that's in the mitochondria.
Yes, and that's in the Krebs cycle. So generally speaking, when you want to make ATP or energy, oxaloacetate needs to bind to acetyl-CoA.
Mm.
And when they bind, they produce citrate, and then citrate undergoes.
And that's why it's called the citric acid cycle.
Exactly. So if you're turning pyruvate into oxaloacetate, you might go, but that's feeding into the Krebs cycle. It's not, because what we ultimately do is pull the oxaloacetate out of the Krebs cycle and throw it out of the mitochondria into the cytosol.
Back into the cytoplasm.
That's right. We can't do it directly, because of the structure of oxaloacetate doesn't allow it to leave the mitochondria. So oxaloacetate turns to malate.
And that's the step before oxaloacetate.
In the Krebs cycle, yeah. It is, yes. So oxaloacetate will turn into malate. Malate can leave the mitochondria, and then it turns back into oxaloacetate. And then oxaloacetate can turn into the step before pyruvate of glycolysis, which is phosphoenyl pyruvate.
PEP.
The thing is, though, we need another enzyme to do that.
Yep.
And that's where, again, glucagon comes into play. It switches another enzyme on and allows for that to happen. So effectively what we've done is we've created our own little cycle of turning lactate into pyruvate in the liver, pyruvate into oxaloacetate, and oxaloacetate into phosphoenyl pyruvate, which is part of the glycolytic pathway. We want to turn this into glucose ultimately.
Yeah, the liver does, because the liver wants to put it out and keep the blood sugar up.
So if we're at the level of phosphoenyl pyruvate and we go backwards through the Krebs cycle, it must go phosphoenyl pyruvate to 2-phosphoglycerate, from 2-phosphoglycerate to 3-phosphoglycerate, from 3-phosphoglycerate to 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate, from 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate to 2-glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate.
So you're just reversing glycolysis here.
That's right.
So the point here, because we're doing gluconeogenesis, the point of this is that we're essentially reversing the 10 steps of glycolysis, but there are 3 points which you can't reverse.
Yes, so I'm getting to that.
And this is the first one we've done, which is the malate oxaloacetate.
No, we already spoke about one of them at the very top.
Oh, okay.
Let me continue this, because I'll explain that. So we're going backwards, like you said. We're now at glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate. We're going backwards, back up now to fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. We can go backwards because all of these steps are reversible.
Yep.
But once we get to fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, it's irreversible to fructose 6-phosphate. Glucagon stimulates another enzyme, which is called fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, and allows for it to be reversed into fructose 6-phosphate. That gets reversed to glucose 6-phosphate. Now, remember we spoke about glycogen?
Mm.
When glycogen needs to be mobilized into glucose, it ultimately goes from glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate to glucose 6-phosphate. And we said it was irreversible to go from glucose 6-phosphate to glucose.
I think this is actually done in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum.
Possibly.
It's not in the cytosol.
And we said glucagon being present allows for that enzyme glucose 6-phosphatase to be present to reverse it to glucose. So effectively, if you were to draw all this out, because of the presence of glucagon, the liver reverses all the steps of glycolysis so that lactate can turn to pyruvate, can turn to oxaloacetate, can turn to phosphoenolpyruvate, which is now glycolysis, and then goes backwards all the way up to glucose, which can jump out into the bloodstream and feed tissues like the brain and the eye and the red blood cells. So effectively we've turned lactate into glucose, and that's gluconeogenesis.
So that's one of the products that we can use to make new glucose.
That's one. But the others are easy now because we've spoken about the pathway, because there are amino acids that jump in at the exact same spot that lactate does, like alanine.
So alanine's a good one, because when you are breaking down amino acids to liberate, to go into the blood, to go to the liver, to then be repackaged into glucose. Mm. Alanine is one of the most abundant amino acids that have been liberated from the muscle.
Yeah.
So then this particular, this is usually given an example, right? Alanine, yeah, as the amino acid that can be primarily used for gluconeogenesis made into pyruvate.
Yep.
So how does it go about reforming that?
So, well, the protein will break down in the muscle tissue and will release alanine. Alanine can get to the liver and will jump in and turn into pyruvate. And then same thing, pyruvate goes to oxaloacetate, which goes to, you know, to malate and then back to oxaloacetate, but then phosphoenolpyruvate and all the way back through the reverse glycolysis to glucose.
Is there anything that has to be done differently with processing an amino acid compared to lactate though?
It depends on the amino acid. So amino acids have amine groups associated with them, and ultimately the amine, which is NH4 plus, is, you know, ammonia based, and that's damaging to the body. So the amino acids need to be processed in a particular way, and ultimately the amine group needs to be sent to the urea cycle so it can be gotten rid of. But effectively, alanine just jumps into pyruvate.
Okay.
But then you've got other amino acids that can jump into other spots, like glutamate can jump into alpha-ketoglutarate, which is part of the Krebs cycle. And pretty much, I think it was you that told me this, nearly every amino acid can jump into these metabolic processes, except two, right?
So there's 20 amino acids.
Yeah.
If we want to simplify it.
Yeah.
So all proteins are made up of amino acids. Amino acids are like the alphabet, yep, for the protein that makes the protein different. And the, I guess you'd say the R group,
yep,
is
the side chain group.
It's the uniqueness of the amino acid, right?
Gives it a flavouring characteristic. It's
flavouring. So 18 of the amino acids out of the 20 can be fed into all these kind of these steps, pyruvate or the Krebs cycle, to make intermediates. And some can be what we call glucogenic, which,
yeah,
means...
Or gluconeogenic, yeah.
Or making glucose, or ketogenic, which makes ketones.
Yeah, or both.
Or both.
Or none.
Or none. And there's two that can't be used for gluconeogenesis, and that's leucine, lysine.
Okay. Now, you can have glutamine and glutamate jump into alpha-ketoglutarate. You can have serine, glycine, threonine. That can be thrown in at pyruvate as well. Serine and glycine can jump in higher up within glycolysis. But the point is that amino acids can be used to make glucose. That's the point.
And that their term would be glucogenic?
Gluconeogenic.
Gluconeogenic.
Yeah.
And so they are essentially amino acids that will either go directly into pyruvate or into oxaloacetate.
Yes.
And then do what you just spoke about, is reverse glycolysis.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. So right now we've spoken about lactate and we've spoken about amino acids. The final...
The additional thing just to say with, we spoke about cortisol,
yep,
being the stress hormone, and we know cortisol is like a glucocorticoid.
Mm-hmm.
And if we use it synthetically, you know, if you want to use it for, say, an anti-inflammatory agent,
yep,
or if you wanted to use it as an immune suppressor, commonly it would be used as a topical agent, so cortisone or hydrocortisone. They put it on your skin when you have conditions like dermatitis.
Yep.
But a side effect of it, it is catabolic. I don't think that's a term.
Catabolic.
Catabolic, specifically the proteins. Yeah. So it breaks down protein. So if you were to put on your skin a lot, you'd actually get thin skin because it's breaking
which
down
kind of protein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the point I'm making here is when you've releasing cortisol in a stress situation during your fast, as Aaron would be in,
yeah,
it would be
breaking proteins.
Broken proteins. So you're going to get a liberation of a lot more proteins.
Yes.
For the energy.
Exactly. Now, the final gluconeogenic substrate is taking triglycerides, so fats. And you said earlier that triglycerides are made up of glycerol and fatty acids.
Three fatty acids. That's the tri.
Glycerol. Yep. So like you said, glycerol is the backbone. So you can take the triglycerides and split them apart.
And what's that called?
It's called lipolysis.
Yeah.
And you can free the glycerol itself.
And so to do that's happening in fat cells?
That's happening in fat cells, yes.
So adipocytes?
Adipocytes.
Now, to do that, it's obviously needing an enzyme.
Okay.
And what would that enzyme be called?
A lipolytic enzyme? What is it?
A hormone sensitive one.
Okay.
And so the hormones during this state would be those three.
Glucagon, cortisol, and noradrenaline.
Correct. Yep. So it's called a hormone sensitive.
Lipase,
yeah.
Okay.
And if you remember when we did the fed state.
We spoke about lipolipase in the endothelium.
There was an enzyme that broke the VLDLs up
to
get the fat into the fat cell to be repackaged up, but this is doing the reverse.
Yes.
So this hormone-sensitive lipase, which has been turned on, it will be turned off by insulin, but it will be turned on by those three. Yes. So when you are in that fasting, glucagon, stressed state, noradrenaline, cortisol, then this enzyme is working hard to be just liberating all these fatty acids and glycerol into the blood.
Yes, and you're right. The insulin is a very strong negative regulator of this. So if you have any level of insulin being released, it will stop lipolysis. And that's important. It's important when it comes to diabetics, and we can probably touch upon that shortly. So we've broken down triglycerides and we've liberated some glycerol. The glycerol can jump in to a part of the glycolytic pathway, which is the dihydroxyacetone phosphate.
Where is that?
So when you look at glycolysis, it starts off with glucose, which is 6-carbon, then goes to glucose-6-phosphate, which is 6-carbon, then fructose-6-phosphate, which is 6-carbon, then fructose-1,6-bisphosphate, which is 6-carbon, but then it splits off into 2 3-carbon molecules. One is glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate, and the other is dihydroxyacetone phosphate, DHAP. They're interchangeable.
Yeah.
Predominantly the DHAP will turn into glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate and create two molecules of that all the way down until it creates two molecules of pyruvate.
From one glucose.
That's right. But here, trying to reverse that,
Glycerol
will jump in at DHAP, dihydroxyacetone phosphate. And then that can reverse all the way through to fructose-1,6-bisphosphate, blah, 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 up to glucose. So glycerol can be made into glucose. So that's gluconeogenic as well.
And again, liver.
And again, this is happening in the liver, primarily in the liver. Now, if we think about...
So if you had those three molecules, lactate, which has come from muscle and red blood cell, amino acids, which are coming technically from any tissue, proteins. But predominantly muscle proteins, and then you have glycerol, which is coming from fat.
Yep.
Out of those three, which one would be, do you think, most effective, most utilized in gluconeogenesis?
Yeah, so if you're looking at an 8-hour fast, right, so you wake up in the morning, haven't eaten anything, like I said earlier, 40 to 70% of the glucose that's being made is coming from glycogen. The next is lactate, and that's constituting around 7 to 18% of the glucose is coming from lactate. The next is going to be the glycerol, and that's going to be around about 5 to 8-ish%. And then the next is going to be amino acids, which is going to be under 5%.
Right.
So that's after 8 hours. Again, an important point here is that if you have a think about what's happening over time, as we get to, let's say, 12 hours, 54% of the glucose is coming from those gluconeogenic substrates. The rest is coming from glycogen. Then at 22 hours of fasting.
Okay, so Aaron's there now for a whole day.
Yeah, so now 22 hours of fasting, whole day basically, 64% of the glucose he's making is coming from those gluconeogenic substrates.
Okay, so
lactate, amino acids, glycerol.
Yep, okay.
But 42 hours.
Okay, so now 2 days he's there.
Yep, 84%. Of his glucose is coming from gluconeogenic substrates.
Okay. So he's completely exhausted his glycogen.
Pretty much.
None left.
Yep.
And now he's relying on lactate.
Yeah.
Glycerol.
Yeah.
And
amino acids. Yes.
Now, would you just keep, because I was always understanding, maybe I mentioned this last podcast, but I was always under the impression that you don't really want to keep breaking your muscles down.
No.
So is there a point where amino acids kind of go, stop breaking the muscles down for energy?
No.
It's just going to keep going.
But remember, it's only contributing like 5% of the glucose.
Not a huge amount.
No. I mean, it increases as the glycogen goes down, but overall, it's the least.
Because I'd imagine lactate's fairly steady. It's constant because red blood cells is always going to produce lactate regardless because it's its end point.
In the liver, alanine contributes 6 to 11%. So it's higher than the average amino acid.
That's because there's more of it.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit higher than glycerol. In the liver.
Okay.
So which can be up to 7-odd%.
Now, for the liver to be producing glucose, which we said is predominantly for the lens, the red blood cells, the brain, there is still, this process of making new glucose requires a lot of energy, right?
It does, yeah, which is strange because you'd think, I've got no energy. How am I getting this energy?
So how does the liver... How is it able to keep driving this gluconeogenesis process?
Great question. Remember we said we're breaking down triglycerides to release the glycerol?
Yeah.
It also releases fatty acids. And those fatty acids can undergo a process called beta oxidation where you turn at least even chain fatty acids into acetyl-CoA.
So just explain to me quickly what a fatty acid is.
So a fatty acid is a long carbon molecule with hydrogens and oxygens attached to them.
Okay. And so the point of shuffling this into the mitochondria is to keep driving the electron transport chain, really?
Well, it's ultimately to produce acetyl-CoA.
Okay. Right? So this is where it'll come in?
This is where it comes in. In the process of turning fatty acids to acetyl-CoA, the process of beta oxidation, which is that process, produces NADH and FADH2.
So they're electron energy carriers?
Yeah. Right now, think of them as ATP equivalents, right? Because ultimately they help produce ATP. Effectively, they're probably equivalent to 4-ish ATP molecules. So the argument is that taking fatty acids and just turning them into acetyl-CoA creates ATP. And that ATP is leveraged by gluconeogenesis to keep it going. But think about this, Matt. We're kicking through this gluconeogenesis, right? Hmm. Insulin's crazy low because we've got no glucose. We're trying to replenish it. So insulin's low.
So here's a question for you.
Well, can I finish or not?
No, this is part of why insulin's low.
Okay.
So you are maintaining glucose levels, though, for gluconeogenesis.
Yeah, but we're eating it up straight away.
Yes, but you're still going to, if you can take a person's blood sugar levels, it's still like 4, let's say, right? So isn't that enough to generate insulin release?
Probably not because most tissues are insulin independent.
No, but we did speak about this, remember, last week or last podcast. Remember when we said when insulin is released from a meal, a big part of its release isn't just the presence of it in the blood.
Yes.
It's also the paracrinal environment of the food in the gut.
Yeah, as the glucose molecule moves through the digestive tract, it stimulates the release of GLPs and other molecules that potentiate insulin.
Yeah.
But your argument still stands that if your blood glucose levels go up, it's going to stimulate insulin release.
Yes.
But the thing is...
Because remember, we did speak about that if you just injected a person with glucose in the IV, they're not getting the same insulin response.
No, but they are getting an insulin
response. They still, yes.
So your point still stands that if you're mobilizing this glucose into the bloodstream, you are going to get some degree of insulin release.
But
we're talking upwards of 24 hours now, right? Yeah. We're talking well upwards of 24 hours where they're exhausting our glycogen stores. So the insulin's going to be continually dropping because we're never going to meet the demands that we require.
I think the big thing here is the glucagon to insulin ratio. It's just, what is it, low to high? So you've got a very low ratio of insulin to glucagon, and that's just outweighing any kind of effect that insulin would have.
Glucagon's high, insulin's low.
Yeah.
But think about it like this. When we've got, so I'm talking about 30-plus hours fasting. We're trying to make new glucose through that whole gluconeogenic process. Remember, a big part of this process is taking pyruvate, turning it to oxaloacetate, and then pulling oxaloacetate out of the Krebs cycle. I said you need oxaloacetate to bind to acetyl-CoA to undergo the Krebs cycle. So we're taking triglycerides, splitting it apart to form glycerol, which is being fed to make glucose, but fatty acids, which are turning into acetyl-CoA.
Mm-hmm.
So simultaneously, you're producing huge amounts of acetyl-CoA, but low amounts of oxaloacetate.
Because you're making new glucose,
because you're pulling it out and making glucose from it. So acetyl-CoA has nothing to bind to for the Krebs cycle to undergo. So acetyl-CoA just accumulates, accumulates, accumulates. When you accumulate acetyl-CoA, it triggers a process called ketosis or ketogenesis, in which acetyl-CoA molecules sort of snap together and get slightly modified to produce ketone bodies, the main one being beta-hydroxybutyrate. There's others like acetoacetate and so forth.
Acetone.
And acetone. But beta-hydroxybutyrate's the main one. So now what's happened in the liver after many – now, don't get me wrong. This will happen after an eight-hour fast, but it's so low. But as you get longer and longer and longer
– So you're talking days, really?
This yes, this really starts to accumulate. And so you start to produce ketones. The ketones leave the liver and jump into the bloodstream and go to the brain. And the brain goes...
It can cross the blood-brain barrier?
Yes. Yeah. And the brain's got no glucose at the moment because it's going, where the hell's all this glucose? You're not eating anything.
Oh, it's minimal.
It's very minimal. The ketones jump into the brain and just turn back into acetyl-CoA. And listener might think, yeah, but that was the problem in the first place. That you can have acetyl-CoA, but if there's no oxaloacetate, how do they bind together to undergo the Krebs cycle? Remember that gluconeogenesis, the process of taking that oxaloacetate out of the Krebs cycle to make glucose, is only happening in the liver. Yep. So the brain has normal amounts of
oxaloacetate.
Relatively normal amounts of oxaloacetate. So ketones can be used to turn into acetyl-CoA to bind to oxaloacetate for the Krebs cycle to occur, and the brain gets ATP.
Right.
And so that's why ketones are used as a backup energy source, not primary energy source, dear carnivore, but a backup energy source once glucose is exhausted and insulin's very low. That's an important point because diabetes, if people aren't managing their diabetes very well and their insulin is basically absent, they start to mobilize fat just like they're starving.
So this would be more likely in states of type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. It can happen in 2, but it's less common as one because one, you are completely absent of insulin.
Yes.
And usually in these cases is the person is in a stress situation.
That's right.
Like they've just had a serious infection, they've just had surgery, maybe they've had a bender, like a lot of alcohol, but that could go with hyperglycemia or exercising vigorously.
Yeah.
So they're kind of mimicking what we're just talking about now.
Yes.
But they are now going into a huge amount of fatty acid mobilization. And, and the liver's been bombarded with beta oxidation.
Yeah.
Therefore, acetyl-CoA is in abundance. And now they're producing a huge amount of ketones. Now, the problems with ketones is they're acid forming.
Yep.
And so then you're likely to go into an acidotic state. And that, in conjunction with the low sugars, is going to cause the problem. Well, actually, it's actually high sugars, but you just can't utilize them.
So the sugars are high, but they're basically not there.
Yeah.
Even though the brain can use them, but the problem is the fact that when you make ketones, you make acid.
Yep.
And that can lead to...
But with hyperglycemia, we're going to confuse everyone now because we're talking hyperglycemia instead of hyper. But because you're hyperglycemic, you're going to produce over a threshold in your kidneys, you're going to lose a lot of water, you're going to have electrolyte imbalances, and so you're going to have hypotension in conjunction with the high acid that's trying to be buffered by potassium, so you're going to have potassium issues. So this whole cascade of effects, which is going to cause the problem with a DKA.
Yes, yes. So at the end of all this, what we find is that...
So in his case, 5 days.
5 days.
He lost 30 pounds.
Unsurprising.
And so that would have been predominantly all fat.
And some water. I don't know.
Yeah, how much water he definitely had very limited amount. Yep. But he would have been burning through his fat stores.
Yes, yep. Absolutely. Absolutely, just to try and generate that glucose. Glucose is important. You're never going to get sick of glucose. If you're cutting all the sugar out of your diet, you're inevitably going to go back to sugar because your brain wants it. Your red blood cells want it. They need it, effectively. And if they don't get it from the diet, they'll make it from the fat. And that's obviously one way that
so what does leverage. What are red blood cells? Because they don't have a mitochondria to use ketones. So are they still entirely reliant on
glucose? Yeah.
So it just has to remain there.
I think there is a backup energy source that can use. I can't remember what it is, but it is basically glucose. Very important.
Mm.
Anything else you want to add to this? We've pretty much covered most of
it. I was just going to mention some of the glycogen storing
issues. Oh, yeah, go.
So these are just some autosomal recessive disorders
mm-hmm.
that when you look at the way that the glycogen is stored and then broken down, that there are enzymes that have gone awry in these conditions. I think there are 15 different subtypes of glycogen storage diseases,
yep.
but there is only a handful that are relatively common.
Yep.
So I was just going to mention when you spoke about the way that glycogen is stored in the liver. So it's kind of like you're just putting glucose molecules on top of each other and try to just compact it into a small space, right?
Yeah, like Lego blocks, right?
Lego blocks, but in branches. Yeah. Okay, so it's kind of like you go to a certain number of glucomolecules in a row, mm-hmm. which is a stem, and then all of a sudden you make a new branch.
Yeah.
You let that run for a period and then another branch.
Yeah.
And this just makes a very bushy bush.
Oh, okay, bushy bush.
So with the glycogen storage disorders,
yeah.
there are, as I said, about 15 of them, subtypes. And the most common are type 1, 2, 3, and 5.
Okay.
What I can do quickly is I'll just say this is what's happened with the enzyme that's not working, and you maybe suppose what you'd expect to happen.
Sure.
So the first one is, in terms of the type,
mm-hmm.
it's the type 1 storage disorder and the deficiencies in the glucose 6 phosphatase.
Okay.
So this is the enzyme that is changing.
It's like the final step of gluconeogenesis.
6 glucose 6 phosphate into glucose.
Yeah.
So what would you expect to happen if that one stopped working?
Everything backs up. Glycogen backs up. Everything that's trying to feed backwards, there'd be no gluconeogenesis because it can't feed to its final step. So I assume it's sort of like you have all these different. It's like everyone from Victoria, New South Wales, and South Australia come to Queensland, but they can all get to the border, but they just can't get in. So everything will just back up into their own states.
Yeah.
And so while their roads aren't blocked, the very last point is blocked. And so my thought would be that everything will just feed into glycogen, right? Everything will just feed into just continually storing glycogen but not being able to use glycogen for glucose production. So in a fasting state,
so it's only
you can't access glucose.
Yeah. So this is the problem. It's only in a fasting state. So if the person is in a fed state, usually a child, they're not going to experience any symptoms.
Of course, because it's going in the opposite direction.
Yeah. So it's only going to be a problem when you're trying to liberate in the early fast.
So they have to constantly be fed in the fed state?
I guess so, yeah.
Wow.
So they've got to be, if they're trying to break down glycogen, they can't break it down anymore
yep.
and they can't produce new glucose from gluconeogenesis because that final step doesn't
right.
work. Yeah.
Good. So it's good when I'm right.
But some of the other side points of it not working
yeah.
would be, well, they're not going to be, what's one of the inputs of gluconeogenesis?
Amino acids, glycerol, lactate.
Lactate, right.
Lactate, okay.
So the lactate levels in their blood go up.
Oh, yeah, because it backs up as lactate.
Right, because they've got no way of clearing it.
Oh, okay, that's
so
not great.
So lactate goes up. Now, also because you're running out of glucose, you're trying to get it from other sources, so fat.
Oh, so you get a lot of lipolysis.
That's right, but your cholesterol levels in blood
right,
go very high.
It just backs up into yeah. the system.
And the other one is because you're trying to, during the fast, you're trying to generate ATP still.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to get those electron carriers, but because you're not being able to do it through other means, you are shooting off other pathways, and one is the pentose pathway, which is one method off the side of glycolysis to generate those electron carriers.
Yeah.
One of the side points of, or the end points of, the pentose pathway is uric acid.
Yeah.
And so they can generate, or they develop a condition called gout.
Yep. Okay. What's another one?
The next one is type 2. This is Pompe's disease. Now, when you look at glycogen in the muscle, that is broken down in a lysosome.
Okay.
Lysosome, should I say. So that whole process of glycogen
breakdown.
Breakdown.
Yeah.
All the enzymes that we spoke about actually happens in a lysosome.
In a muscle.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, the enzyme lysosome acid maltase.
Acid maltase.
Lysosomal acid maltase.
Okay.
That's an enzyme that plays an important role in the glycogen breakdown.
Yep.
That is the mutation in this particular case. And so the lysosome doesn't have its ability to break down glycogen effectively, and glycogen starts to accumulate in muscle. This is only for muscle because our liver doesn't do it in a lysosome.
Oh, okay.
And so muscles will start to accumulate.
So is it a lysosomal disorder then, would you call it?
Well, it's still an enzyme, but it's in the lysosome.
So you got glycogen, so they get muscle weakness?
Well, they'll just get accumulation of the glycogen products in the muscle.
Oh, so they get big hypertrophy.
Yes. So, and that would be in all types of muscle.
Interesting.
So it would be in smooth.
Yeah.
It would be in heart, so they get cardiac myopathies.
Wow.
They get it in skeletal muscles, and that they probably end up dying from respiratory failure.
Why?
Well, skeletal muscle is a diaphragm.
Yeah.
And then they have feeding disorders because the gastrointestinal tract, smooth muscle.
Oh.
So that can't.
All right.
Yeah.
Next one.
Do you want me to go through them all?
Well, how many are there left?
Two more?
Yeah, okay, go.
Okay. The next one is Corey disease. So that's the type 3.
Is that associated with the Corey cycle?
You'd think so, but no. Maybe it's the same guy.
Is that lactate?
Maybe.
Is that the lactate cycle?
Yeah.
Because we spoke about lactate leaving muscle, entering as pyruvate, leaving as glucose, turning into lactate and going back and forward. That's the Corey cycle,
That's
right?
Corey cycle.
Yeah.
No. But I'm assuming the same person who named that.
C-O-R-I?
C-O-R-I, yes.
Yeah, so it's the same. Okay, go on.
But it's not the same cycle.
Okay.
So this in this particular case, the problem is the debranching enzyme. So this is where you're putting, to make glucose, you're going glucose, 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 branch.
Yeah.
And where you put the branch, instead of the carbon 1-4 on the stem, you're doing 1-6.
Okay.
To cut that, which is an enzyme,
we don't have
you don't have it.
Right.
So again, you're having the same problem as the type 1.
We're basically storing cellulose.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not being able to break it completely. So you've got chunks of glycogen when you're trying to break it down.
And same symptomatology.
Well, the only difference between the first one, the first one was glucose-6-phosphatase, which is a regulatory step for gluconeogenesis. This one isn't. So all your gluconeogenesis is still working.
Right, you just can't use the glycogen stores.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
So you'll still develop hypoglycemia in an early fast because, remember, you spoke about glycogen being the first primary source, but you can still overcome it through gluconeogenesis. So it's not as severe.
The treatment for this is just less sugar intake because... And because you can rely on gluconeogenesis.
I think it's the treatment here, but I'm happy to be corrected, is a lot more complex carbohydrates in your diet.
Right. Okay, what's the last one? Because I want to talk about ethanol metabolism quickly before we go.
The last one is McArdle. This is a type 5.
All right.
And this one is a phosphorylase, a glycogen phosphorylase, which is this is a glucagon-dependent enzyme, so that it needs to be phosphorylated for it to work. This is only in the muscle, though. And so this would be kind of a less severe form of the Pompe's disease, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, but that one is kind of like if you can keep the muscle out of a fasting state or when it's highly dependent on glycogen, it should be okay.
So my thought would be constantly feeding but not a lot
of exercise, not extreme exercise where it needs to be using glycogen.
Okay.
But
how common are these metabolic diseases? I assume rare, right?
Well, probably in the pediatric population, which they are
prevalent. But they're not chronic lethal, right?
Yes. You mean leading to death?
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Oh, they are?
Some of them are.
Oh, okay.
Some of them may require enzymatic injections.
Right.
But I think some are just, you can't overcome that because it's so widespread. But they are autosomal recessive, so you obviously need two of them from each parent.
Yeah, because that's a loss of function.
Yeah.
Because all of these have been loss of functions.
And I'm guessing these may be conditions that we will look to in the future to have genetic manipulation to overcome these.
CRISPR.
Yeah.
Ethanol, alcohol. We can use ethanol to make energy. So it isn't gluconeogenic as a substrate because it doesn't make glucose, but ethanol makes abundant energy.
And that's that was the hypothesis that I read some time ago, that animals that develop the ability to break down ethanol for energy, because if you think about it, let's say primates, mm-hmm. which would have been eating fruits. Fruits is obviously...
They can ferment.
A fruit is a source of a lot of sugar, right?
Yeah.
But if it started fermenting, you would lose the benefit of going, well, now it's not going to be useful for energy metabolism, right? Mm-hmm. But if you have the ability to break down the ethanol, which
then
isn't...
It is.
Then it is. Yeah. So there's a benefit for the primate, let's just say, to be able to process
ethanol. But here's the detriment. So when you take ethanol, ethanol's poisonous, right? Like it's not a great thing for us. We need to metabolize ethanol. So we turn ethanol into acetaldehyde. When we do that, we create NADH, and that's where we get the energy from, right? Because we can feed that to oxidative phosphorylation. And you might think, oh, cool, ethanol, we get energy. The acetaldehyde needs to be further broken down into acetate, which is done in the mitochondria, and that creates even more NADH. More energy, brilliant. The acetate then needs to go back into the bloodstream and need to be peed out and gotten rid of. The problem is the NADH that we make, which you'd think that's weird. If you are getting NADH from ethanol, the NADH levels go pretty high. And high levels of NADH is like having high levels of ATP. It's a negative regulator of glycolysis and the Krebs cycle. It says we've got enough energy, which is a pro-storage signal. So it then tells the body, if you're drinking alcohol and then you're eating a lot of glucose, you know, because you drink a lot of piss, you get a lot of alcohol in, you start to get hungry, right?
Is that why you get hungry?
One of the reasons why you get hungry is because you're not using the glucose for energy. You're not, because it says we've got enough energy. So it says, oh, it's pro-storage now. So it doesn't just turn the glucose into glycogen. It pushes it into fatty acid synthesis as well because we've got heaps of it. And so you actually start to produce fatty acids and you start to produce triglycerides and VLDLs. And from
is that why chronic, you get fatty liver?
That's right. That's alcoholic fatty liver disease.
Yeah.
But you also get hypoglycemia because of that, because the glucose has been stored. But also because, and you get reduced gluconeogenesis, but you also get hyperlipidemia as well.
Yes.
So the ethanol, simply just by boosting those NADH levels, is negatively regulating all those things, resulting in just sort of like tweaking the metabolic pathways just off kilter a little bit so that it's now in a pro-storage state.
Do you think that's how it kills bacteria?
No, I think it just puts holes straight into them, doesn't it?
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Because ethanol is produced by
product.
Yeast, right?
Yeah, that's like us producing carbon dioxide or lactate. It's like producing lactate.
But in doing so, it's inhibiting bacteria growth, right?
Well, it's a byproduct, I suppose.
So do you think that is a method of how it keeps away from each other?
I assume so. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. Have we covered fasting state, Matt?
I think so.
Well, I'd just like to thank the Biochemical Society. I'd like to thank our dear listener. I realised on our website that we've got hundreds of unread emails there, which were hidden from us, but I've got them now.
So what I thought was happening is that we were bypassing our website into our personal email.
Yeah.
And because I was receiving a lot of emails from people.
Yes.
That was, complimenting or asking questions.
Yeah.
Or spamming.
Yeah.
And I assumed that we were just getting everything that was coming through the website.
No, there's heaps. So if you've sent us an email and we haven't addressed it or spoken about it or thanked you, we're going to try and do that very soon.
We may not get through all of them.
We may not get through all of them, but I'm going to be downloading them.
But we are doing episodes where we are answering questions.
Yes. So send us your email again if we haven't got back to you or if we haven't spoken or mentioned your email on the podcast. Send us another email because it's probably one of those ones that
I got lost.
Matt didn't read. but look, you can contact us on social media at Dr. Mike Todorovic, DrMiketodorovic, or you can send us an email, gubiosciences@gmail.com, or you can go to our website and we will read it and access it now. Or you can send us an email, admin@drmike.com.au. Apart from that, look, we're just...
I'm going to go eat.
Yeah, I'm not starving, but I feel like I need some food. My blood glucose levels are starting to fall.
Bye, Mike.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.